Well, hi, everybody. It's January 28th. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. We're now part of the American Consortium for Equity in Education over at ace-ed.org. That's ace-ed.org. We do a lot of work with equity in K-12. We'd love you to join with us. Free to educators, and you can go over there. You can see all the stuff we're doing. Again, it's free. All right, we have our issue up on site, brand new issue, just hit the website today of our online journal, which is pretty damn good, I got to tell you, called Equity and Access. You'll love this issue. All of our issues, our past issues, are archived there, but the brand new issue is now up on site again at ace-ed.org. You will really enjoy it. It's fabulous. And by the way, I got to tell you, I love the cover. It's just incredible. All these podcasts are also over there. You'll see an icon called Podcast. We want you with us. Join with us. It's free. It's fun. And we want to hear what you have to say over at ace-ed.org. I have a show today that I am really looking forward to doing because I got Patty West Smith here. Patty is the director of customer engagement at friends of mine called Turnitin Company. You know them, and a lot of work they do is in plagiarism, but they also do a lot of work in assessment, and they know a lot about data. And we talk a lot about equity, but there's got to be a way to measure that, okay? And Patty, who is, and we're going to talk about what her title entails, okay, is going to talk about the use of rubrics in the pursuit of equity. Patty, are you there?
I am.
Hi, Patty. It's Larry here. How you doing?
I'm well. I'm well. Sipping my coffee.
Right?
In
good
to talk
girl.
About
I love
equity.
It. I'm sipping mine, too. Okay. Are you in Delaware? I noticed your area code.
I am. I'm in Delaware. Yep. I work from home, and
I'm
at my kitchen table.
Where are you in Delaware? I'm from that area. I grew up in West Philly, and I went to Westchester.
So I'm all the way at the southern end of Delaware, almost to
the
Maryland line, just about 30 minutes away from the beach.
Good enough. No problem. Okay, because
yeah.
I'm more familiar with the northern side of Delaware, the second smallest state, okay, in the country, home to President Biden, I might add. How about
that's
that?
That's right.
Yeah, how about that? Delaware hits the big time, I got to tell you. It's been a long time since Caesar Rodney is all I can say. You know Caesar Rodney?
A long time.
You know
oh,
Caesar
yeah.
Rodney.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody in Delaware knows Caesar Rodney. In case people don't know who Caesar Rodney is, I have to get into this. Okay, Caesar Rodney with jaw cancer, okay, rode all night in the rain from Wilmington, Delaware to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania to cast a vote for independence. He was quite a guy, a nice big statue of him in Wilmington. That was a good ad. He's pretty cool. That's Delaware for you, right?
Yep.
First
and
state.
Caesar Rodney High School is not too far from us.
There you go. It's Caesar Rodney. Okay, excuse me. In Delaware, it was the first state to ratify the Constitution, just in case you don't know that, everybody. It's on the license plates. Okay? Patty, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I want you to talk, before we get into this equity thing about rubrics, you have the title Director of Customer Engagement. And while that sounds like something, maybe I'll send out marketing information, that's not exactly, I don't think, what it is. I want you to define that title because a lot of that title, especially these days, correct me if I'm wrong, has to do with data, okay, understanding data. And we're always talking about equity. Okay, equity. That's our American Consortium for Equity. But we talk about it. We try to make it happen, but we can't put it into numbers. Okay, so maybe you can help us do that. Talk about your title, Director of Customer Engagement, and talk about data. Thank you. Patty West Smith, everybody.
Sure. It's a big title, right? But it is kind of nebulous, and I think a lot of people don't really know what it means. So my background is in public education. I have about 2 decades of experience in public education, but I've been with the company now for about 5 years. And the role that I serve is really to be a direct connection between what we do as a company and our users. It's my job to show up and be the voice of teachers and students and administrators and speak to their needs in the company, and then going back out to make sure that we are addressing that we are communicating clearly to those same folks on the other side. And in terms of data, I spend a lot of time looking at what it is people care about, what it is people need, what's happening in the world, and keeping track of what that really means in classrooms literally around the world. We have customers everywhere around the world.
You do. I know.
Yeah, we do. And in terms of data, we think a lot about how it shows up, how it impacts kids in particular, and what are some of the trends. And so, you know, you sort of laid the groundwork for this early in our conversation. This idea is out there that we know that the data tell us that there are clear discrepancies among different groups of students. Sometimes that shows up in the quality of the education, but it very often shows up in the achievement of different groups. And so for many years, researchers have been doing, really been looking into why that happens. And now we're at the place where we are really looking hard at what we can do about it.
I think that's wonderful. I want to say a couple of things about what you just said. First of all, were you a math teacher? Were you?
I wasn't, actually. I'm a literacy person, a hardcore literacy
person. I'm very
person.
Impressed with you, Patty. That's pretty cool, what you do now and your background. I'm very impressed. Okay, I got to tell you, that's really cool. And I love the whole literacy thing. And the other thing you said about your job, and I've been talking about this a little bit this week on the podcast, the industry to the educators, to the profession, the industry and the profession is a symbiotic relationship. The industry needs to know what teachers and professionals need. And by the same token, the professionals need to depend on the industry to provide them with what they need. And the fact that you're in charge, quote, of customer engagement, if I may, which is going to sound funny, you're also in charge of Turnitin engagement because you're giving your company feedback to get the proper things back to them. It's a fascinating relationship, and most people in education see the relationship when they meet the sales rep at the school or in these days online. But the relationship goes much, much deeper. Patty's a perfect example of that. We can apply mathematics and logic and rubrics to all of these things that we're talking about. Okay? So besides rubrics, are you talking about Rubik's Cube, that thing with the colors and you have to match them all? That's what you mean. That's a joke.
Different rubric.
I know. That's rubric. Okay. So what? Talk about rubrics and how you go about your job and how we can measure it with equity and all that sort of stuff. This is fascinating. I've been looking forward to this all week. Go for it, Patty. Talk about what makes for a good rubric. Mademoiselle, literacy teacher, make me literate about rubrics.
So the fundamental thing to understand about rubrics is they can take a lot of different forms, and that's fine, right? And you'll get a lot of big brains who will talk to you about what's the difference between an analytic rubric and a holistic rubric and a scoring guide, and, you know, all that stuff is fascinating, and I like to talk about it too. But when you boil it down to its simplest terms, a rubric is about mapping out the criteria that is involved in demonstrating learning, and then clearly mapping out what the performance level descriptions are. So what does it look like if a student has mastered skills and concepts, they're proficient in that? What does it look like if they are not proficient but working toward it? And then on the other side, what does it look like if they're actually advanced? And it really comes down to language, and it's about precision. And so I oftentimes say about rubrics that really at their heart, they are a communication tool. And a rubric, a really good rubric, is a communication and a conversation between a teacher and the students, between the students and their work, between the student, the teacher and their grading, and even between the teacher and parents. So a well-crafted rubric has a lot of power in a classroom. And it can also be a tool that has this incredible impact around eliminating bias. Well, eliminating is probably not the right goal here.
Yeah.
Minimizing bias.
I like that. Yeah. We're always striving to eliminate it, but trust me, we never will. Okay.
Exactly.
We never will.
And actually, I would say, Larry, that is a fundamental idea we have to acknowledge, right? Because the start to making this happen is accepting that bias exists in all of us. Right. If we don't start it's almost impossible to start to mitigate the impact of it. So we have to accept that it's there. And rubrics can help us do that, right? Because rubrics allow us to really clearly define what it is we expect from students. And that becomes a tool for us as the educator. We can really map out exactly what we're expecting, what that's going to look like in very concrete terms. And that's really important for us to make sure we have a clear perception of exactly what it is we expect students to learn and master. But then it becomes even more powerful because it communicates those expectations to students in ways that almost become a roadmap for them. They can literally look at that rubric and say, this is where I need to be. This is what I need to do to get to this performance level. So I talk about rubrics and sometimes people tease me because I'm like a disciple of rubrics. I cannot overstress how valuable I think they are.
How did you – I have to ask you this because, you're a literacy teacher, a literacy coach, whatever, okay, and that's what your background is in. How did you come to this epiphany? And that's a very good – it's a very logical epiphany, okay? And a lot of people wish – I'm being serious here. But it's something that most people don't see, okay? And to me, it's very important. We work a lot in education, at least I did. Maybe I'm the only one anecdotally. Okay.
Right.
I saw kids. I got to know my kids. I got to feel them, know their families, etc. And I worked in that. But that again, that builds up a bias. Okay, the people who were nice to me, I liked better. And what can I tell you? I didn't like anybody else. Okay. So, but you know what I'm saying. All right. And how did you come to this epiphany? What did you see? What did you start seeing that made you realize this could be turned into something very logical? I love this conversation.
Well, so I have to go really far back in my career because I'm old.
Let me
now,
finish
Larry,
that sentence. I love this conversation. Oh, mighty disciple of rubrics. There you go.
So I have to go really far back in my career. As a literacy person, one of the big things that you have to launch into when you get into the classroom is you have to start grading writing. And let me just be real candid. Most of us in the literacy world have had very little specific training around grading and scoring work,
absolutely,
right?
You might get
one class, you know, in your undergrad, you get one class and they talk to you about, how to construct items and things like that. But there's not much attention paid to how to grade effectively and fairly. So in my early days in my classroom, you know, I'm out there and I'm gung-ho and I've asked my students to write a paper and I wake up one morning and I'm looking at my desk and there are 130 essays staring back at me, right? They have to be, it's kind of horrific. I have a little bit of PTSD about it. I'm not going to lie to you, right? It's really, 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 really tough. And you know what happens, Larry? You go into that first one and you are writing comment after comment and you're circling and you're drawing arrows and it's animated. By the time you get to essay 130 in that pile, right, 130 essays later, you're writing like, good job, smiley face at the top, or see me later, right? It's just like this weariness factor. It's exhausting. And so, you know, like most young teachers, I was kind of facing that challenge, and I had this amazing supervisor, right, Ann Lewis. God, this woman is an icon in my life.
Wow.
But she was a genius. Yeah. So she taught this class that was an add-on for young teachers, which, by the way, is a challenge because young teachers don't have a lot of energy for extra classes. But she taught this class that was like, she called it a rubrics academy, and I was like, all right.
Wow.
But the description said how to make it easier and more effective to score your writing. And I was like, this is a class I need to go to.
Wow.
And I go, and we spent like
a week.
Was
she at the university or was she at the high school?
She was both. She was at the district office as a curriculum supervisor, and she was a professor at my undergraduate alma mater. I had a lot of interaction with her. But she taught this Rubrics Academy, and it was 7 days total of six to 8 hour sessions. And it was all about how you can take a lot of the subjectivity out of scoring writing away from the game, right? And this was long before I had really started to think about diversity and equity work, which has become a passion of mine. But, you know, I was there because here I was dealing with this mountain of papers, and I wanted to figure out how to handle that. But what I got out of that class was so much more than that, because I started to understand how my unconscious bias could impact my scoring, right? And the research here is really clear, right? The research has indicated for many, many years that gender bias persists in grading practice, racial and ethnic bias persists in grading practice, bias related to socioeconomic status persist in grading practices. There's no question of this. This is in no way debatable. The research is, I couldn't even name you all of the research studies that have been conducted over the last 20, 40 years that mm-hmm. have proven conclusively that this is a sincere problem. And it goes both ways, right? Because sometimes our bias makes us score high, and sometimes our bias makes us score low. So it shows up in lots of different ways, but there is a lot of subjectivity in it, particularly as it relates to writing. Because scoring writing can really come down to, in some cases, do I like this writing style? Which is just the wrong way to think about helping students, because whether you like it or not is irrelevant. But a lot of scoring of writing has ended up coming down to those very subjective standards. Rubrics take a lot of that out because they force us as the educator to clearly articulate exactly what content we expect students to have learned and mastered. And that takes all the subjectivity around away from it, right? If we're talking about how well constructed a thesis is, you know, there are particular elements that we're looking for that we should be looking for, and a rubric drives that scoring, and it gives us this very precise, clear criteria that we mm-hmm. can follow to avoid any of that subjectivity. When I was a curriculum supervisor years later, I used to do rubric training, right? So I would work with a group of teachers, and we did what's called table scoring. And so you'd sit down with a rubric, and you would all grade the same piece of work with the rubric. And then you would come back together as a group and compare those scores and try to figure out where the scores were off. And you would be shocked at the variability that comes out of that. But rubrics really drive that conversation.
It's a great exercise. I wouldn't be shocked, to be honest, nor surprised at the differences, and that's the whole point of this. Okay? Let me ask you, by the way, I have to say something here before we get in further. I'm going to go to an interesting website, and I'm not just saying this because you work there. Everybody, go to the turnitin.com, turnitin.com, okay? Because everything on this website, not everything, but a lot of it, they have a whole section on secondary education, okay, and yep. has a lot, and higher ed, but has a lot to do with saving time, understanding assessment, and giving quality feedback, which is exactly what you're talking about, Patty. Okay,
yeah.
And I just wanted to say that the website of Turnitin, okay, is reflecting all the things that we're talking about here. Can I ask you to give us an example of a rubric, and maybe one that I don't know if this is possible about equity or diversity or something like that? Or is that impossible to do? But what would be a good example so that people could understand this?
Okay.
Is that possible?
It is. So the first step to writing a really good rubric is to sit down and clearly map out what is the criteria you're looking for, right? Because when you're looking at a performance from students, whether that's an essay they've written or a lab report or even like an actual performance they've given in music or art, what you have to ask yourself is exactly what criteria am I using to score this, right? And those come down, and a lot of times you'll hear people call those the traits of the rubric. What are the traits that you're looking at? And so in writing, you'll see things like how strongly stated is the claim, how much evidence is integrated, how well organized is the essay, and how do they use language conventions, right? Those might be four traits that you're looking at: evidence, claim, organization, language conventions. And then what you have to do is map out a scale of what those performance descriptors look like. So in, let's say, evidence, did they use sufficient evidence to support their ideas, right? That might be at the proficient level, right? You're matching up proficient and sufficient. But then you can go beyond that, right, to say, what about those students who excel beyond that? And so you start to change your descriptors, your modifiers, to match what is going above the standard. And then you do the same thing from the other side, coming down from that. If a student isn't quite at that proficient level, what does that look like? And so you really map out those concrete descriptors in each trait, right? Remember I mentioned evidence, claim, organization, language conventions, and then you want to map those out. Now, a lot of times folks think that rubrics are really only a thing that matters in writing. Not true. Any kind of performance that students are creating has criteria that you're looking to score, right? And it has different varying levels of performance. And those pieces, performance levels and criteria, or traits as they're sometimes called, those are the heart of what makes a good rubric. And in terms of how this relates to equity, so one of the things you have to realize is, going back to that bias conversation, is that most of the time, I believe teachers show up and they want to do the best job possible. I don't know any teachers who show up and say, I want to do an awful job with kids, or I want to hurt kids. That's not what drives us, right? We don't get out of bed. Out of bed. No. But things show up, right? Things show up that we aren't expecting. So the way that rubrics really play into equity is by staying what we call on rubric, right? You're only scoring the criteria that is in that rubric. It starts to eliminate some of the bias that creeps into scoring, because you aren't looking at all the factors in the universe. It isn't open-ended. You aren't scoring every little thing. You have this criteria that you've mapped out that drives your scoring. So I'll give you an example. So right now in the world of equity, in particular around rubrics, there's this conversation because there was this research done by David Quinn out of the University of Southern California. Uh-huh. And in this research, he found that when teachers are not using rubrics, there can be a great differential in the way that they respond to student writing with very, very slight cues. So in this experiment that he did, he put together two pieces of sample writing, elementary school, second grade, I think, right? So not real complicated writing. And the only thing that he changed in his two samples is the name of the kid's brother. So in the one essay, it's my brother Connor, right? Connor, kind of a neutral, probably white sounding name. And in the second version, my brother Deshaun. That's the only thing he changed. You with me? When teachers scored that, when they scored that in an open-ended, subjective way with no rubric guiding their scoring, there was a split. 35% of the teachers scored the Connor essay at or above grade level. Only roughly 30 to 31% of teachers scored the Deshaun version at or above grade level. No other difference.
No rubric. Wow.
Right?
Wow.
Now we go back in, right? Same two pieces, Deshaun and Connor. They score them with a rubric. The rubric has specific criteria. It has specific performance descriptors, right? Guess what happens? No difference in scoring between the two papers. None. So it really, it serves as an example. It's only one example, and we're not talking about a mass study,
but it's a very good example, and it always reminds me, and I mean, this is fairly obvious, okay, when people get a resume, okay, and I'll use your words, when they see Connor Johnson versus Deshaun Johnson, okay, the bias, again, not necessarily intentional, sets right in. You can't help it. I should say it that way. Okay. But to me, that's it's scary and it's sad, and it's something that we do. It isn't that amazing. And the rubrics that you're talking about need to be set up everywhere, not just in school, but obviously in resumes by human resources people, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's the same exact thing. The question I have, as you set the traits, okay, at the very beginning, which you hope will kind of level that playing field as you review them, I'm going to have to say it this way, if you're in a school where you have lower expectations, will your traits represent that? How do you make sure the traits are equal? Is there a way to do that, to start it?
That's a good question. So there are a couple things you should do that can help, right? Number one, if the stakes are really high around the scoring, right, like this is something that's going to impact students, let's say, advancement to the next grade, right, or it's a huge milestone sort of performance in their work, it's a good idea to work with some other folks, right, because when you're the only person constructing that rubric, your bias can trickle into it. Now, not possible on a day-to-day basis. But when you're talking about milestones or really high stakes work, you want to have a group that's involved. Why? Because when you have a diverse group with diverse perspectives, you're much more likely to have a rubric that is equitable, that that represents that well. But there are some other things you can do. Number one, make sure you construct your rubric up front. What you don't do is do all your teaching and then build your rubric. Because when you do that, what you've taught drives your assessment criteria.
Yeah,
it drives
yeah.
your expectations.
Yep.
But when you design your assessment tool, your rubric up front, and you map out, this is what I want students to have learned by the end of this unit, then you set that course up front, and it isn't skewed along the way by those expectations that come up in your classroom. So you want to do that work up front. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? You think, well, I don't do my assessment until the end. But you want to start there. You want to start by knowing where you're going.
It's not your assessment.
Right?
It's the way you're going to assess. It's the roadmap to assessment. Okay?
Exactly.
You get out
right?
the roadmap
and that
before
will
you
then
take
guide
the
your
trip.
Teaching.
Yeah. You get out the
and
roadmap before
guide
you get
your
in
teaching.
The car. And by the way,
absolutely.
I'm showing my age because there are no roadmaps anymore. But you know what I mean. Just
well,
so you know.
So
there used to be these
analogy.
Things called roadmaps. Yeah. Yeah,
they
yeah.
were big paper things. You had to fold
yeah.
them. Yes, I
yeah.
remember them. I've seen them in
yes.
museums, Larry.
Yes, that's
yes.
exactly right. And you used to get that out before you started the trip. But you understand
exactly.
the analogy there, right?
Right. You don't take your recipe out after you've cooked the meal. You build
thank
the
you.
Recipe
we'll use recipes.
Front.
Thank you. We'll use
there
recipes.
You go.
Thank you very much. Better
I'm
than
I'm here for you, Larry.
Thanks, pal.
I'm here.
I appreciate
I'm here
that.
For you.
And obviously, you have lowered your expectations considering who you're conversing with here. Thank you. Thank you. Recipes better than roadmaps. That's funny. Okay. All right. I talk about this for a second. This is kind of cool. Turnitin, it's a measurement company. I'll call it that, okay? And you can call it what you want. But go over, as you do your work, how does that work manifest itself back to the customers? What are you guys looking to do with the information that you have about all this stuff? Your customer engagement information, i.e. the rubrics, the traits, if I may, however you want to say that, how does it manifest itself on the other side as it comes out the other end?
So that's a good question. So there are a couple ways that show up
thank
pretty
you.
Obviously. Like you mentioned our website, right?
Yeah,
so if
good.
You go into our website and you take a look at some of those resources, you'll see we have blog posts. My team
that
and I write a number of those, right? We bring that expertise to these sort of thought leadership pieces to help drive the way people use our products to make sure that they're most effective. But we also create actual instructional materials that go out into classrooms around the world. We create videos and PowerPoint presentations and activities and assessments and tests and a variety of those kinds of resources. And then we do other things, like we actually create rubrics and sets of feedback that our customers can use with our products, right? Because we want to
cool.
not just talk the talk, we want to walk the walk. So we create the actual resources that teachers can use to follow the theory that I'm sort of preaching, right? So I don't just talk about good rubrics, I build them, and then we produce them for
exactly
teachers to use around the world.
Yeah, exactly my
yeah.
point of asking. You build them and you use them. I'm going to ask something because we're winding down here. I love this
sure.
topic about using rubrics for equity. Patty, can you write us an article for our magazine about this?
Oh, Larry, you
yes.
got me on the spot. How
I know.
Can I tell you no? Of course
they
I'll
can't.
Do
that's
it.
Why,
of course
that's
I'll
why
do
I'm
it.
Asking you in public so you can't say no.
You make it impossible for me to say no.
The
I'm
rubric,
leaving this podcast
the,
with homework, Larry.
The rubric, okay, that I wrote down before the show was embarrass Patty enough to ask her if she will do this, okay, during the show, okay? So there may be some bias
built
in there.
I will do it.
But when you have the rubric, the recipe, if I might, it works out at the end, okay? But
it
this
does.
Is fascinating, and you're really good at explaining this. But the whole idea of
thank
preparing,
you
know, and again, I'm serious, and we're always talking equity, but we got to make sure that we have a step-by-step procedure to measure that, okay? And that's
yeah.
what the
yeah.
rubrics are doing, okay? So we'd love to have
yeah.
you. I'm going to introduce you to Maya, who is our editor, and you guys can argue it out. How's that sound?
All right, Larry.
You'll love her.
You.
She'll love you. You'll love her, okay? But now that I've embarrassed
okay.
you into saying yes, so you have no choice. Is that okay?
I'll do it. I'll do it.
Thank you. And if you want, you can just copy from some – oh, no, that's right. It's Turnitin. We'll catch you for plagiarism.
No, we don't copy. We don't do that, Larry.
That would be so bad if somebody from Turnitin plagiarized an article. Think about that.
That would be the end of someone's career.
That would be the end.
Yeah, that's a career ender.
You can't do that. So you can't.
No.
So you can't do
that.
Nope,
this has to come from my brain.
There you go. All right, so it works out perfectly. All right, it's great. This is so fascinating, I got to tell you. I want to ask you one thing before we go. Rubrics
okay.
are fine. You're working with your colleagues, et cetera, but real quick, how much do the students know about the expectations that you have? How does the rubric, I mean, what impacts their grade, so to speak, just to get to the bottom line, but on the road to the grade, are they familiar with the rubric you're going to be measuring them by?
So, Larry, I have to tell you, if I were a preacher, this would be my moment, right? Like, this is the moment
I live
for.
You are a preacher. Go for it.
This is the most essential thing about rubrics, right? Remember I said up front, rubrics are essentially a communication tool, right? And we made this analogy to the recipe. So here's the thing. You don't want your students trying to cook a different dish than what you had in mind. You want them to cook the dish you had in mind. In other words, you want them to learn the content that you needed to deliver. If you don't give them the rubric up front and communicate your expectations clearly, you can't expect them to walk away and make the dish you wanted them to make. You have to give them the tool so that they understand exactly what is expected from them, right? And I would say as early as possible you do that. You don't wait until the end to give them that recipe, which is what the rubric is. You give them the recipe up front. This is exactly what I want you to do. That way they know what they're shooting for. It's a critical point, an absolutely critical point. And in fact, some teachers even involve students in constructing the rubric. But that's probably
a whole other podcast,
Larry.
It might be another podcast. I got news for you. I really enjoy this. This is great stuff, Patty. You are really an expert in this, and you are a preacher, by the way. Okay, you are a preacher.
You.
You're doing a good job. It's my pleasure to give you the pulpit.
I appreciate it. I love to show up and talk about rubrics.
And then do a little Jewish guilt and get you to write an article. So I think it's fabulous.
Just a little bit.
It's good. It worked out. Patty, you're wonderful. Thank you so much, okay, for this.
Thank you, Larry.
Great. Okay, you're a terrific guest.
Take care.
Thanks. I'll be back to you, okay? Look for an email from me. Thank you.
I will. Have a good day.
You too, Patty. Bye. Patty West Smith, everybody. Incredible. Director of Customer Engagement for Turnitin. What a nice lady. Thank you, Ian, for helping me find Patty there over at Turnitin. Okay, the use of rubrics in pursuit of equity. What can I say? Hey, we'll archive the show, share it with your friends. It's over at ace-ed.org under podcasts. It'll be downloaded in just a few minutes. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks, Patty. Thanks, Turnitin. Thank you all.